Today we're getting not only a history going back to the woolly mammoth, but a clear look into the very successful regenerative work of Peter Allen at Macedon Valley Farm. Not unlike the water running through Peter's property, his background in teaching ecology and complexity science has fed his every effort in creating this ecologically functional and economically profitable agro-ecosystem. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for September 2024. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. Peter, I imagine your history in ecology research and complex systems science gave you a broad and very unique perspective for designing and or restoring healthy agro systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think using the tools of the system science and looking at things as systems, you know, a lot of ecological research is pretty reductionist. You know, you're looking at the relationship between a specific species of insect maybe and a specific species of plant and trying to understand that. But that was really frustrating to me. And so I really wanted to understand how ecosystems functioned. Specifically, I was interested in, you know, restoration ecology. How do we restore ecosystems? And a lot of the approaches used to restore ecosystems, especially in the Midwest and Eastern United States, are pretty reductionist. You know, you see that a landscape has an invasive species, so you go in and try to remove the invasive and plant natives and then kind of walk away and give it back to nature. But after spending a lot of time looking at specifically ecosystems in the Eastern United States and the Midwest, in particular the grassland savannas, and real looking at them holistically as functioning systems, you realize that at least for the last 10,000 years, humans were an integral part of those ecosystems. So any attempt to restore them that doesn't include human activity is bound to fail. Like, it won't be successful, as a caveat, without the presence of assuming there's no megafauna around eating trees, then, you know, humans need to be actively involved in the management of those ecosystems. And we know for 10,000 years, Native Americans were actively managing these ecosystems specifically to produce food. They were managing them agriculturally. So I guess the systems perspective allowed me to sort of have that to see holistically and realize that humans were a part of it. And so I kind of had the realization that the best pathway for me to actualize these restorations were to do it by example, to go purchase a plot of land and integrate myself into that ecology as the mechanism to restore it. And so that's kind of how we got started.
Tell us about your land and where it is, the size, landscape, et cetera. And when did you get started doing this?
So, let's see, it was 2012 that we came out here, so it's been about 12 years that we've been here. We're in southwestern Wisconsin in an area called the Driftless region. The upper Midwest was flattened by glaciers for 3 million years of off and on ice ages, except for this one little corner of southwestern Wisconsin, which for some reason the glaciers completely missed. They went all around us to the east and west and joined back together in the south, so we're completely surrounded by glaciers during the ice ages, but never covered in ice. And so we retain our historic topography. We're actually, I'm on the Kickapoo River, which is considered to be the oldest watershed in the world. There's another one in Africa that they think might be about the same age, but hundreds of millions of year old watershed landscape ecosystem. And so I was really drawn to this area. We came here about 12 years ago and bought 100 acres, and now I lease another 120 or so. We basically use livestock to do our restoration work, and then we sell meat as the economic engine to keep it going, to fund it. And so we raise grass-fed beef and pastured pork and grass-fed lamb and pastured chicken, and we also raise goats. That's our primary way to control and clear brush that is ever present on our landscape.
Right. The never ending brush story.
That's it.
Yeah. You purchased your land quite carefully. I know you looked at so many properties and you chose one with many ecosystems on that property. Can you speak about that? And are there both disadvantages as well as all of the advantages? How do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, being a complex systems guy, I wanted sort of like maximum complexity, which sometimes I question that decision, although ultimately I'm very happy here. But we have a very complex topography, lots of hills and valleys. And so because of that unique topography, we have a lot of different soil types. You know, every hill has different aspects, south facing, east, west, north facing. Then there's valleys, there's springs, there's trout streams, there's wetlands. So there's lots of different ecosystem types. And so when we were looking for land, I didn't want to just buy a 100-acre ridgetop field. I wanted to buy land that had lots of these different microclimates or micro ecosystems within them. And we ended up finding a really nice property that had sufficient pasture to be economic, but very complicated topography, lots of hills, lots of valleys, really steep hillsides of all different aspects. We have lots of different plant communities, more maple-dominated woods on the north-facing, more oak-dominated on the south side and west side. We have sandy soils and clay soils. We've got multiple springs and streams and trout and otters and wetlands, and we got a little bit of everything. So as an ecologist, I really enjoy getting a chance to interact with all these different systems. As a businessman, it's much more complicated to manage and make profitable complex landscapes than, you know, 100 acres of flat ridgetop pasture. But, you know, I am glad I did it. But I did set myself up with some extra challenge.
Did you, from the get-go, know what would go where with these different landscapes? You mentioned whether a hillside is facing north or south or east or west, and the soil actually is different from something on the opposite side? Or is it a real kind of guessing game initially?
Well, it was apparent, not necessarily in the abstract, but in the real world, there's just lots of constraints. So, like, there's existing fences, you know, there's water in specific places. To change that context is incredibly expensive and usually doesn't pay off. So, you know, you're kind of constrained by physical reality for a lot of that stuff. And there's a lot that we've done to sort of improve the existing infrastructure here, but that's a very slow process of building fences. And having these really steep hillsides that we graze makes things like fencing much, much more challenging. Like, you can't drive skid steers or tractors or utility vehicles on big chunks of our land because it's way too steep. And so getting materials places becomes extra challenging and expensive. There's a lot more labor involved. So we're really constrained in terms of how we lay things out by just the physical reality of
gotcha.
The farm itself.
Sure. When I initially made contact with you, I wanted to talk about keystone species and why they're important. And then I noticed something on your website. What prompted you to write on a board at one of your classes, "Keystone Species Need a Tribe"?
Well, it's just that, you know, we can't do it on our own. Like, I guess I shouldn't speak for everyone. I should speak for myself. There's a sort of myth associated with farming and homesteading of, like, you're sort of like independent, self-sufficient, and everybody's trying to be self-sufficient. And I actually think that's a really good thing. We all need to be more self-sufficient. But at the end of the day, the only way we're going to make really meaningful change is if we work together and coordinate and cooperate. Yes, we need to be the keystone species of our own ecosystems that we live in, that we call home, but we also need a tribe to scale it up, to make more systemic changes. Because I can be the king of my 100 acres, but I want my watershed to be healthier. I want to, like, stop the flooding that happens here every year because of the way that the ridgetops are managed. We get massive floods that never happened before. Our water table's going down because of the way the ridgetop fields are managed. Like, I want to heal our watershed, not just my 100 acres. And to do that, we've got to work together.
Are you finding cooperation with your neighbors?
It's a slow process, but I've made a lot of progress in 10 years. Yes. It's obviously much slower than I would like. I tend to get impatient sometimes and have to really settle down and realize the kind of battle I'm up against don't happen overnight. So,
yeah.
Well, you were talking about the maples and the oak trees, and you've planted such a huge number of trees on your properties, and yet I've heard you say that you need to tame the forest. So walk us through your vision of balance within that ecosystem of the trees.
Sure. I'll back up a little bit and just say that the historic ecology here and in much of the continental United States, and if you go back far enough, even the Great Plains had much more trees on them. But these were grassland savannas. So they're continuous grasslands, right? I mean, it's full-on grazing lands, grasslands, with scattered trees and shrubs. And when you have sufficient cover of trees, when the trees shade out the ground underneath them, then that kills the grasses, and then you move towards the forest. And in any ecosystem that gets sufficient amounts of rainfall and moisture, if you just leave it alone, it turns into forest. So here in the Midwest, you know, in our area, we get 35 inches of rain a year. If you take a piece of land and let it go and don't do anything, within 20 years, it's going to be closed canopy. There's not going to be any grasses. It's just going to be trees, and that's going to turn into what they call a climax community, which around here is dominated by maple. And so, like a nature preserve, where human activity is minimized, you're going to end up with these closed canopy forests, which do not produce much food for humans, isn't what was here historically, and is much lower biodiversity and ecosystem function than a grassland savanna. But when you have as much moisture as we do here, it's an active battle to maintain open grassland because the forest is always trying to take over. And so it requires constant management to keep things open. Historically, like the last 30 million years, that was done by giant animals like beavers the size of Volkswagen bugs and ground sloths that could reach 12 feet up into the canopy, giant camels, giant bison. I mean, there were bison twice the size of the American bison that we know of that are here now. And there were elephants. There was the woolly mammoth. There was the Colombian mammoth. There was the mastodon. And specifically the mastodon, the woolly mammoth was a grazer. It ate grass on the tundra. But the mastodon was a browser. It ate trees. And it would use its giant body size, giant mass, to push trees over and strip the leaves off of them. So they were giant deforestation tools. And you can imagine a herd of 80 mastodons walking through a forest, just completely opening it up. And you open up the forest, grasses start to grow, and then that attracts grazing animals, which will help maintain it. You know, the horses and the bison. And sure, the camels that were here that would have been helping to maintain those grasslands. So for 20 to 30 million years, we had grassland savannas across the United States. And when all those large animals went extinct, the forest grew up. And the Native Americans arrived and cleared the forest out, mostly using fire, and then maintained the open grassland because that produces so much more food. Because the trees are usually nut-producing trees like oaks and hickories and walnuts. And then the grass attracts grazers, so you have meat and fruits and nuts in this system that you don't get when it's a closed canopy forest. And so the landscape where we are today now, typically if you look at a definition of what a savanna means, it's like 50% canopy cover of trees. And I actually think that's a little high. I like 20 to 30%. But let's just say for, you know, rule of thumb, 50%, you look at any plot of land from 40 acres to 400 acres in our region, it's fractal in the distribution of trees and grasses and open areas. And basically at any scale you look at, it's half woods and half open area. So our 100 acres, I manage 220 acres now. If you look at that from space and you look at it, it's half continuous canopy forest and half open area, either cropland or pasture. What we need is trees in the open areas because there aren't any. And then those closed canopy forests need to be thinned out if our objective is to create savanna. My objective is to create savanna. So I've planted 10,000 plus trees in the open areas and in the forest. I'm in there clearing. You know, we have in our forests 150 to 200 year old oak trees that are open grown. They grow their branches stretching outwards which is the form that trees grow in when they're out in the open, when they're surrounded by grass and not other trees.
Yes.
In a forested context, trees grow straight up because there's so much competition for sunlight. When there isn't competition for sunlight out in the middle of a grassland, they grow outwards. And so we have these outstretched oaks that are now completely surrounded by elm and ash and maple trees. That are a signal to us of the past, of what it used to look like. It didn't used to be continuous cover forest. It used to be open savanna. And so we're trying to restore that open savanna, both by opening up around the legacy oak trees, but also making sure there's regeneration of those oak trees, targeting specific young trees to keep and to open up around so that they can, over the next 150 years, grow into those open grown forms. You know, that's a challenge, but that's what we're embarked in doing here.
Sure. Peter, that just sounds like such a more than full-time job, just doing that, and you do everything else. This is incredible. It's quite amazing. I know you went in initially and planted a large variety of grasses. What did you plant, and then did you immediately start seeing species from the area that just came up on their own? How did you see that? How did that work?
Well, like our original farm had, or I guess I should say our farm now has about 80 acres of pasture, and then it had about 40 acres of cropland. You know, it was all in GMO corn and soy. You know, the pasture is the cool season grasses. And I love cool season grasses.
Sure.
There's some debate as to how native some of them are. It's kind of thought that all of them are from Europe. I'm of the opinion that some of them have been here all along, but, you know, that's a debate. But we've, you know, these cool season grasses are the standard pasture grasses. It's the grass you have in your yard, Kentucky bluegrass, brome, Timothy grass, orchard grass. These are the grasses that green up in the spring, and they're lush, you know, if you have a good rain all year long. What we know was here before was the tall grass prairie. And the tall grass prairie wasn't dominated by cool season grass. It was dominated by warm season grass. So that would be grasses like Indian grass and big blue stem and little blue stem and switchgrass. It's a different kind of grass altogether. They're called warm season grasses. It's a different photosynthetic pathway, the C4 pathway, which has a really interesting origin story, but we don't have to get into. But the warm season grasses are those big, tall prairie grasses. You know, they talk about the early settlers, they could ride their horses through these grasses and they could reach out and grab the tops of the grasses and tie them together over the backs of the horse. I mean, they were growing 10, 12, 14 feet tall in really rich organic matter soils, grassland soils. In the pastures of the eastern United States, the Midwest, I mean, you got to go pretty far west into the arid regions to get any native warm seasons just growing in pastures that are utilized by cattle. In the croplands, we kind of had a bare slate, and so when we removed the crops, we came in and planted the native warm season grasses. And so now we have 30 to 40 acres of prairie and then our 80 acres of cool season grass pastures, and it's actually really nice to have both. I actually really like the cool season grasses because the warm season grasses, they really grow when it gets hot in June and July, but they don't really photosynthesize much in the spring and in the fall. And the cool season grasses, they're actively photosynthesizing and sequestering carbon and providing forage for livestock in the spring and fall, of which in the upper Midwest we have, you know, long springs and long falls. And so it's really nice to have both present in the ecosystem.
Absolutely. Tell us about replacing and growing topsoil. When my dad was an apple farmer many years ago, the myth was, oh, you can't be organic because you're never going to get the yield that you need. And for a long time, the myth has existed that it's going to take eons to get topsoil back. And yet, when people are focusing and doing very productive things like you, the topsoil does come back, doesn't it? And it comes back much quicker than what the old myth was talking about.
That's right. So to understand soil, we've got to understand two different things. There's grassland soils, and then there's forest soils. Forest soils have really thin topsoil banks, you could call them, reserves, the humus layer, because most of the carbon in that system is grabbed and translocated up into the biomass of the trees. So there isn't this big, huge reserve of topsoil. Grasslands are unique on planet Earth in their ability to grow topsoil as a byproduct of the ecology of grasslands. And the process of large herds of ruminant animals, of grazing animals, coming through and grazing, eating grass, trampling it into the ground, pooping, and having many species do that in sequence. You know, we know, like in the Serengeti, there's very specific sequences, like first the water buffalo comes through, and then a specific species of antelope comes through, and then another species of antelope comes through, and they're each grazing. They have their preference for what part of the grass plant they want to eat, and so the ones that like the top of the grass comes in first, and then the middle section, and then the low section. There's some antelope that will only eat, like, the tiny little bit of grass that's left after all the other animals have eaten it. And when you have these systems of grasslands and grazing animals, the result of that is it builds topsoil because they're trampling vegetation into the ground. So that trampled vegetation gets eaten up by microbes and stored in the soil as soil organic matter. It builds carbon. And then also the act of eating parts of the grass causes the grass plant to slough off parts of its root system, which then gets eaten up by the microbes and turned into soil organic matter, which builds carbon. In the Midwest, say in Indiana, Illinois, you know, it was tall grass prairie for at least 8,000 years. But before that, it was the Ice Age, and the glaciers scraped off all the soil, right? And then they retreated and melted away. And there are places in Illinois that had 20 feet of topsoil.
Oh, my gosh.
20 feet of topsoil that had accumulated over only 8,000 years. And so the old adage that it takes 1,000 years to grow 1 inch of topsoil is it may be the case in poorly functioning ecosystems, but in a high functioning ecosystem, it's much, much, much more rapid than that. And so when you look at the agricultural areas of the world, when you look at the breadbasket of Europe, you look at Ukraine, you look at areas in Russia, and then obviously the Midwestern United States, those were all former grasslands. And the grains that we grow on the grassland soils, they're called mollisols, we only can do the kinds of cropping that we do because of the activities of those ecosystems over eons that built up all of that topsoil that we then mine through that resource in the activity of growing large-scale monoculture grains. And we're, as a civilization, we're at the end of that accumulated resource base. We've used and run through it. And so we need to rebuild our supplies. We need to, like, make deposits into our bank account instead of only withdrawals.
Right.
We inherited, here in the United States, this massive savings account of feet of topsoil. And we've really burned through that in the last 150 years, and now it's time to start rebuilding it so that the next generations can continue to thrive here in this continent.
Yes, and I thank you so much for all of your efforts. It's incredible. And you mentioned it's so cool when you look at the whole system, right? The animals that come through, they enjoy one kind of the grass or feel like that's what their nutrient is. And for someone starting out, is there a particular animal that you would start with? You have a lot of variety in your place. Do you recommend, like, get a few cows, or would you get two cows and then two pigs, or how do you see
it? Depends upon the ecology of the place.
Gotcha.
And basically every ecosystem is out of balance now, and so certain types of livestock will push it back into balance. So depending on the vegetation of your place, and will depend on how it needs to be pushed to get back towards balance. So for example, around here, this is the dairy region of the United States. Wisconsin is the dairy state. There used to be tens of thousands of small dairies here, all with, you know, less than 100 cows. That is not the case anymore. I think our county 30 years ago had like 80 dairy farms, and now there's like three, you know, and each one of them has 3,000 to 5,000 head of dairy cows. I mean, it's crazy the change that's happened. And so there's been these rippling changes on the landscape. And one of the changes is that, you know, these new giant dairies, they're not grazing their animals. They're inside 24/7. So there's all this marginal land that used to be grazed, and it used to be in cool season grass pastures. And now, because they've pulled the cows off, they're starting this process of succession. And around here, that often happens. They get dominated by forbs, by specifically goldenrod around here. Canada goldenrod just forms the monoculture. And so to push it back towards a balanced, diverse grassland, we can use species like sheep, which prefer forbs over everything else. Every species of livestock or just grazing animal in general, but we have livestock to work with, right. Has specific species and specific types of forage that it prefers. So it'll have its like highest preference species, then mid preference species, and then low preference species. And an animal like a sheep prefers forbs above and beyond everything. Middle preference is grass, low preference is browse. And so if you have an area that's dominated by forbs and it needs more diversity of grasses to get back towards a healthy grassland, you want sheep on that landscape. Now, if you have a landscape that's been taken over by brush, say a multiflora rose or buckthorn or honeysuckle, then you want a browsing animal to come in there. And you would want to start with goats, because goats preferentially browse those species over everything else. If you're trying to restart a pasture from scratch, you're going to want a ruminant animal that has the right biology in its gut to help inoculate those soils to restart the biological process of soil creation, and cows are the perfect species for that. So it really depends on the ecological context of the place, what species you kind of want to start with, and then from there you expand to create even more ecological functioning by including more animals. So you might start with sheep to clear out the goldenrod or the forbs to get grasses started, but once you get the grasses started, you're going to want to bring some cows in, for example.
Right.
And then it's on from there.
Yes. You have brilliant classes that you share. In designing a homestead, what do you recommend as a first step, and how does that compare to your initial first step?
I mean, I think I have pretty similar answer to the last question, which is that it really depends on the context where you're starting from as what
gotcha.
Those first steps should be. For example, for us, you know, I built our house close by a spring, right? We have abundant water resources here. And so developing infrastructure for water, that was actually a pretty low priority. It was years before I like started doing any kind of piping or plumbing for water, because I had so much water available. Yeah, it was a little bit of a pain to move it around, but I had it just available. I didn't need to spend $20,000 to drill a well 500 feet down
sure.
to access water. And, you know, water is such a critical, I mean, it is the critical resource for humans, for animals. And so, you know, you always start with the water. So depending on your situation, like our situation, I didn't have to really even think about water for years until we were more further along in the process. So I really think there's really not a one-size-fits-all, like, recipe for starting a farm, starting a homestead. Every piece of land is different, and every human personality is different. The most appropriate way to interact with the land is really finding the resonance between the personality of the human being and the personality of the landscape. And so it's a highly individuated process. You know, the place to start isn't even so much ABC things to do on the land. It's more internal work of trying to like understand who you are and understand the very basics about your landscape so that you can start engaging in that process of discovery with yourself and with the land. In our courses, I've developed a regenerative context worksheet that sort of has people go through and answer all these questions about themselves and their personal life and their personality and their financial situation, their social situation, in order that you can have a really firm grasp on that in order to be able to make realistic plans with the landscape. And so I do think it's a highly individualized process.
Sure, yes. Well, you've been teaching for quite a while now. What do you think your students have reacted to most surprisingly? Is there anything that comes to mind? Or?
Well, I don't know about surprisingly, but I do think, you know, what I'm talking about in this process of defining your own situation and defining the situation on the land, people mostly come in expecting a blueprint, like there's some handbook and you just follow steps 1, 2, and 3, and then, you know, you
voila.
Find success.
Yes.
And so with the current paradigm and the way people think in the modern world, I think that is the most challenging. I mean, I know personally when I do consulting work, people just want me to come to their property and make a plan for them, a map. And it's like, I can do that, of course, but the likelihood of that plan coming into full fruition is near zero if I'm not fully considering the lifestyle and context of the individuals that will be engaging in that work. You know, people have different amounts of time that they can put onto projects and labor, a different amount of resources. All of that has to be considered for a plan to be successful. So my approach in consulting isn't actually to make tangible plans. It's to help people make their own plans and to guide them and assist them on that process, which requires a lot more effort than a lot of people want to put into a project, because it really requires a lot of introspection and really careful decision making about resources and finances and time. Everybody wants just like a instant solution. We're just going to like have this amazing homestead in year one. And if it's going to be successful in the long term, it really needs to be fully fitted into your life. It's got to work within the context of your existing life. And so it's a sort of difficult process, but once you commit yourself to engaging on it, it's actually really fun and fulfilling and worthwhile.
Absolutely.
And most of our students end up doing that, and it ends up working out. You know, people have to be ready for that because, you know, it's not what people are expecting most of the time.
Right. It's interesting hearing you speak about all of this so clearly and succinctly and wisely. It's so surprising that majority of the population fell into the reductionist viewpoint from the get-go, isn't it? Because it's such an evolving natural system. It's surprising.
The really comforting thing about reductionism is it simplifies, and it makes things simple. It's like, oh, the climate change, you know, if you want to lower the temperature, you just lower the carbon. There's one variable that matters, and it's a thermostat. You just lift it up and down, and this incredibly complex system within tons of variables, with variables inside the system and variables outside the system, like the galactic center, and energy coming from space and going through cosmic dust clouds that impact our sun and how much energy it puts out. It's so completely complex that causes anxiety because it's fundamentally unpredictable. And humans really want to feel secure and feel like things are predictable and like we understand what's going on. We can predict the future. We know that next year my paycheck is going to come. I'm going to be able to make my mortgage payment. Everything's going to be okay. And I think that's in some ways a flaw in our software, in our like mental way we approach the world, is that we're constantly looking for simple answers and we're really uncomfortable with complexity. And the truth of the situation is that the world is complex. At a very fundamental level, it's unpredictable. Like, we're just not going to be able to predict the future. And we need to, as individuals and as a species, we need to be comfortable with complexity, comfortable with uncertainty, and develop the skills to be able to adapt to the changes that come, whether we expect them or not. And I think that's really an issue that humanity needs to confront, and that's like a skill we need to be able to attain in order to basically continue as a species.
Yes, Peter, absolutely. And if you want to go after that, folks, farming is a good way to get the lesson, isn't it?
It is 100% the best way, because nature doesn't care about your feelings, and it's going to give you immediate and obvious feedback as to your ideas about what's right and what's wrong. It's a very humbling experience to come out. You know, I came out of graduate school and I'd studied all this stuff and I had all the answers, and you come out and start doing stuff on land and, you know, some things work and then some things don't, and nature is not shy to just like smack you down and say like, yep, your understanding is not right. You need to reform your models about how reality works because it's not working here. And so it requires a level of openness and humility to be able to accept that feedback. A lot of people we'll just ignore the feedback, and then, you know, then they get smacked down harder and harder and harder. But it definitely takes a level of humility to be able to engage in that constant feedback in order to be able to improve and grow and get more and more in tune with the land and with the landscape.
Peter, how can people reach you to find out more about your classes and consults?
Sure. So MastodonValleyFarm.com is our farm website. We sell meat. We ship meat all over the United States, beef, pork, and chicken. And then MastodonValleyFarmSchool.com is our website for our courses. We have a free course that you can sign up for. And then we do design courses where we help walk people through figuring out what to do their own property. We do those a couple times a year. And then if you want, you know, some consulting or some help with figuring out what to do in your place, feel free. You can contact me through the website, or you can email me at peter@mastodonvalleyfarm.com.
Most importantly here, what's your favorite cut of meat to eat?
Oh, that's a good question. I was just with some family, and they asked me the same question. You know, I love a good steak. I love a good ribeye, but I also really love a brisket, like a well, slow-cooked brisket with a lot of fat. And I really love the oxtail. Like, the oxtail, I think, is a really undervalued cut because it's got all the connective tissue in there and the collagen. And there's ways to prepare it that it's just unbelievably delicious.
So we've been listening and learning a lot from Peter Allen at Mastodon Valley Farm. For anything related to what we do here, we can be found at cultivatedaudio.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.